Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. We open our show today with an important update on the drought's impact on farmers. Following Governor Brown's drought emergency declaration, two more pieces of bad news have just come out about the drought. The Federal Bureau of Reclamation has announced that it will reduce the flow of Colorado River water, a decision that could be felt across the Southwest, including here in San Diego, which relies on the Colorado River for about 60% of our water needs. Now, another 20% or so comes from the state, but now the State Water Project has announced this week that it will not deliver water to its customers, including farmers and cities across the state. The Federal Central Valley Project, the largest single supplier of agricultural irrigation water in the state, is expected to do the same unless significant rainfall occurs before the first allocation announcement next month. As California's water situation worsens, the leader of the state's largest farm organization says rural areas face severe economic problems from this water shortage. The California Farm Bureau Federation President, Paul Winger, called the State Water Project announcement a terrible blow, but said it's not unexpected given the relentless drought punishing California. Under current conditions, we expect hundreds of thousands of acres of land in the Central Valley to go unplanted, Winger said. That will cause severe economic problems in our rural regions, loss of jobs and economic activity, with all the heartache that entails, he added. Like many Californians, he said, farmers and ranchers have improved their water use efficiency significantly in the years since the last record drought in 1977. Since 1980, for example, the amount of water applied to ag lands in California has gone down 24%, while the tonnage of the crops produced has increased 34%. Winger said, we're consistently achieving more crop per drop, but greater efficiency can only go so far, and when water allocations fall, oftentimes the only choice for farmers is to reduce production. Farmers will face many difficult choices in coming weeks. He said the Farm Bureau will work with state and federal government agencies to seek effective responses to the water crisis, both in the short and long term. Now, fish and wildlife will also suffer from lack of water. Winger says many of these negative environmental impacts could have been avoided if California had done a better job of planning for the dry years, including construction of new surface storage facilities. It's a mistake we can't afford to continue, warned, and then said there's a dire need to improve California's water storage. He said that will allow us to better cushion ourselves against damage caused by drought and long-term variations due to climate change. And he said it's time to pass a bond measure that includes new surface storage projects for water. Despite the worsening drought statewide, San Diego has not yet imposed any mandatory conservation requirements or water rationing on its residents, saying that for now they have enough supplies on hand. However, Governor Brown has asked all Californians, including those in our area, to conserve water by at least 20%.
Emergency drought legislation is heading to the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives. The bill by Central Valley lawmakers would halt the restoration of the San Joaquin River and send more water to farmers. In announcing the bill, Representative David Valadao blamed California's water shortages primarily on failed government policies. Opponents say the lawmakers are using the drought as a scapegoat. Kim Delfino with Defenders of Wildlife says suspending environmental protections for public health and wildlife will make absolutely no difference in the drought.
It's not going to generate more water. It's not going to make it rain because the reality is that there just isn't additional water to be had.
Delfino says suspending federal and state laws to export more water to farm fields would have a devastating impact on the salmon industry. She says salmon are already stressed and dying because of the lack of water.
Salmon industry is a $1.4 billion industry in California, and it would devastate it. It would also impact water quality for Delta communities, Delta farmers. It would impact water quality for the Bay Area communities that are taking water. out of the Delta.
The Sacramento-San Joaquin Valley Emergency Water Delivery Act was introduced last week after the House and Senate Agricultural Committees rejected the lawmakers' attempt to put a drought policy rider into the Farm Bill. California Senator Dianne Feinstein, who is drafting her own drought legislation, calls the bill irresponsible and dangerous for California. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
San Diegans will hold a candlelight vigil Monday night as part of a national protest against the Keystone XL pipeline. A final environmental impact statement released this week by the U.S. State Department on impacts of the pipeline has alarmed environmentalists. They have organized a candlelight vigil urging President Barack Obama to deny a permit for the controversial pipeline to pump tar sands oil from Canada across America. Locally, the vigil will be held Monday night, February 3rd at 6 p.m. in front of the Federal Building at 880 Front Street in downtown San Diego. Organizers say the public is the last line of defense to halt the project. The State Department's report triggers a 90-day national interest determination with input by other agencies to the department, after which the State Department will issue a recommendation to the president regarding final approval. According to the Washington Post, the State Department report issued Friday concludes that the proposed Keystone XL pipeline would be unlikely to alter global greenhouse gas emissions, though officials caution that they are still weighing whether the project would meet the test of President Obama's broader climate strategy. That conflicts with conclusions of NASA scientist James Hansen, who has called the Keystone XL pipeline, quote, game over for the climate, predicting that if constructed, it would release such massive amounts of sequestered carbon from the oil sands that climate change would become irreversible. Other climate scientists have said that two-thirds of all known fossil fuel reserves need to remain in the ground to avert the worst impacts of climate change. But the State Department report whitewashes those concerns, stating climate changes are anticipated to occur regardless of any potential effects from the proposed project. The report does, however, note that the pipeline would fuel carbon dioxide emissions equivalent to 300,000 cars and that there is significant risk of oil spills causing ecological harm. 1,692 pipeline incidents in the U.S. have already occurred. Opponents of the pipeline have said they fear the powerful oil industry lobby has influenced the report's findings. In Canada, the Pembria Institute has said that pollution from the controversial oil sands remains the single largest barrier to achieving Canada's national 2020 goals to slow climate change. Senate Republican Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, claims the report shows, quote, no reason to continue stalling construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. He has called on the president to approve it because he said, quote, America needs those jobs. But Michael Brune, executive director of the Sierra Club, says the public has the power to win out over what he calls spin from the oil industry, noting that Obama had promised to reject the pipeline if it would significantly exacerbate carbon pollution. Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth have both launched petitions against the pipeline. In San Diego, Monday's vigil is co-sponsored by SanDiego350.org with support from Citizens Climate Lobby, Sierra Club San Diego, Women Occupy San Diego, and other local organizations. Two prior rallies against the pipeline held last year drew 200 and 500 people, respectively. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
This is Miriam Raftery with the latest on a controversial industrial solar facility proposed in East County. The Boulevard Planning Group will be hearing from county staff and Soitec solar representatives this Thursday night at 7 about a draft environmental impact report for Soitec's proposed industrial solar projects. The four projects combined in Boulevard would include nearly 9,000 solar panels, each 30 feet tall by about 50 feet wide, covering roughly 1,700 acres of wetlands and meadows along the state-designated scenic Old Highway 80 in this rural community. Residents are overwhelmingly opposed. They say they object to the destruction of scenic views, as well as use of groundwater for grading and washing all those panels during the worst drought in state history. They're also worried about glare. Now, at a Soitec community presentation last week, representatives from Soitec and its consultant, Dudek, insisted that their panels are treated to resist glare. However, photos East County Magazine has obtained of a similar Soitec project in Newberry Springs, California, show a very bright glare off project panels. Now, supervisors out there issued a moratorium on new solar projects after residents complained of glare off solar panels, though Soitec has insisted those complaints weren't related to their projects. That moratorium has since been lifted. However, residents in Newberry Springs have complained loudly that they were blindsided by the Soytec project. It was initially proposed to be just 8 feet tall, and then Soytec took over ownership of the project and changed it to have 27-foot-tall panels that obscured mountain views. Property values dropped as a result, residents say, and the residents here in Boulevard fear the same could happen here. Boulevard and Hacumba residents have voiced concerns that Soytec, just like SDG&E with its recent substation in Boulevard, might have seriously underestimated its water usage. SDG&E used 3 times more water than it estimated for its substation, and they blamed this massive miscalculation on dry soil in this high desert area. The draft programmatic EIR for Soytec's project includes an estimate for water use that also appears to have omitted a concrete batch plant for making concrete on site, which typically is a very water-intensive activity. Now, East County Magazine is working with one of our news partners, Reviving Gaia, a new site that is devoted to environmental news, and they're going to be investigating how much water was used at other Soytec projects around the country. So stay tuned. We'll be reporting back soon on just how accurate their water use predictions were. Over 70 people turned out last week at Soytec's community meeting. All residents who spoke with us said they opposed the projects. One woman, Teresa DeGroot, said she drives 135 miles every day to work just so she can enjoy living in the backcountry. She said, "When I retire, it's all going to be industrial out here," and her voice was tinged with anger and sadness. A March 2012 letter from Soytec executive Mike Armstrong to Ron Roberts, who at the time was chair of the Board of Supervisors, asked that the board direct staff to fast-track approval processes for Soytec's projects and to prepare what's called a programmatic CEQA document, California Environmental Quality Act, that would allow compliant projects in the future to be streamlined and approved without the normal environmental reviews. Another Soytec letter that's been provided to East County Magazine back in November was sent by Soytec's Patrick Brown to Joseph Ferracci at the County Planning and Development Department. He asked for an amendment to the Boulevard General Plan to allow Soytec projects to go through. Supervisors soon after gutted Boulevard's general plan that the community took 20 years to create over the objections from local residents and all of their planners in order to enable Soytec's project and other industrial-scale renewable energy projects to be approved. Soytec promised to bring manufacturing jobs to the San Diego region, and they have opened a factory in Rancho Bernardo. The company also argues that its products help meet clean energy goals for the state, which also ordered fast-tracking of the Soytec projects. A preliminary list of concerns about the projects submitted by Donna Tisdale, who chairs the Boulevard Planning Group, along with the Protect Our Communities Foundation and Backcountry Against Dumps, a citizens group, states that general plan amendments were made to benefit commercial interests at the expense of residents and other non-participating landowners, and that these changes are biased, unnecessary, and unjustified. The document cited objections, including adverse impacts to historic Route 80, scenic and open views, and an area that's also rich with wildlife and peaceful scenes of grazing livestock. Such radical changes will negatively impact rural community character, also posing fire dangers, risks to the water supply, and removal of land from availability for other more compatible uses such as vineyards, the citizen groups say. Boulevard residents have already filed lawsuits seeking to block several other controversial projects in their area, and some energy companies have pulled out and canceled projects, such as Jewel Valley Wind, when faced with a firestorm of community opposition and the prospect of costly legal challenges in the future. So the future for Soytec's project in Boulevard and others is far from sunny, with shadows looming on the horizon as community opposition grows. Now, some residents in rural Boulevard and neighboring Hacumba have launched an online petition through MoveOn.org asking supervisors to save their wetlands and wild areas from destruction by the Soytec project. You can read this petition, and if you wish, sign it at MoveOn or on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from San Diego County. Healthcare in California is changing. Are you ready? Professionals from Mountain Health and Alpine will give a presentation about the new Covered California Healthcare Marketplace, California's approach to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. The event will be held Thursday, February 20th at 6 p.m. at the San Diego County Library in Alpine. You can learn what is covered in the new California Health Exchange Marketplace, how the program works, and how you may be affected. Guests are encouraged to bring questions to this event.
This is Miriam Raftery with a weather update. As you've probably noticed, a winter storm is sweeping across our region, and an urgent winter weather message has been issued by the National Weather Service. A low-pressure system has brought in cold air and icy temperatures and, yes, rain that's forecast to continue off and on through Tuesday. Now, if you're heading for the mountains, you'd better grab your galoshes because snow has already fallen up there, and more snow is possible above the 4,000-foot level. There's also a chance of thunderstorms early in the week, and over coastal areas, watch for waterspouts. Now, rain is good news for our drought-parched state, but a winter weather advisory also means travelers may face difficulties. Be prepared for slippery roads and reduced visibility. Use caution when driving, and if you must drive at the higher elevations, be sure to carry chains, extra clothing, food, and water.
White cake. We do spice cake. We do carrot cake. Oh, don't forget the cornbread. We also do cornbread.
Maria Gonzalez is teaching an industrial and commercial baking class.
I also teach them how to do pizzas, calzones. So if they want to go into a pizzeria, they know how to go into there.
I've learned all the machines, the production, the bread machines, the cake machines.
It's called the Culinary Baking Program, and she's got quite a captive classroom.
So here, try to smile. We're not in the best situation ever.
That's because they're in jail. It's one of the vocational programs offered inside detention centers. It provides rehabilitative services to inmates while they're in custody.
I can make my time go really slow here and do nothing. But instead, I put myself into a situation where I get to learn something and do something for myself.
I mean, I've been incarcerated for a while. This is my first time in county jail. These programs are pretty helpful.
Spread them out evenly. That way it's nice and even. If not, the cakes come out like this.
Classes are taught by certified instructors and take about 6 months to complete.
The cakes look pretty good, guys. A little bit overdone.
The idea is to give inmates real skills that can help them be a success once they get out of jail. Maria says there's definitely challenges teaching inside a jail.
The difference here in the bakery, we have no tools, okay? And it's very hard to work without tools. I can't have blades in order to score the bread, and we score the bread in order to know what kind of bread we're making. So if I do 3 slashes on the bread, I know it's French bread. If I do 4 slashes on the bread, I know it's sourdough. That's the kind of stuff we do outside. Here, we don't have that kind of luxuries. So what we do, we get a spatula and hit the bread.
Once they learn the basics in the bakery, if inmates want to know more, then they advance to what's called the finished product phase of the class.
We're going to be making carrots.
This part of the course is taught by Irene.
See how it stops looking like a scary tree now?
Who just happens to be Maria's sister.
They work with chocolate. They work with whipped cream. We also have fresh fruit. Go up, go down, and it's a lot more hands-on training and presentation. You know, making the food visually appealing.
You gotta have an eye for this decoration, presentation. For anybody to really eat anything, you know, presentation is the main thing. Besides, the food has to be good, gotta be able to present it.
Everybody loves to see their name.
They learn techniques and what kinds of things they need to be thinking about.
So if they wanted to say happy birthday or welcome home, we always have to leave a space for it to have wording on it, okay?
So what happens to all these treats? Most are for staff and inmate meals within the jails. And they even get catering requests for special events within the sheriff department.
And we get the same reaction, too, of the quality of the product that goes out. A lot of them are kind of surprised that it comes from prepared by inmates.
Slowly, very, very good.
It's really quite sophisticated what they can do here.
You see them, they're part of gangs, they have all these tattoos, but then they're being really delicate with things. It's actually kind of funny.
When they're done with the class, the completion certificate is the same as anyone else would get on the outside.
Very good.
Even if they don't choose to pursue this professionally, the inmates have other ideas on how to use these new skills.
For one thing, I know that I'm going to make something for my mom.
Brownies. For my grandpa, he loves brownies.
But now they want to show their family
I know how to do this. And I know how to do this at a professional level. We're teaching them something that they could go home and be proud of. Imagine your kids. Hey, you've already been in jail. You got something negative on you. But you know what? If you could go home and for Thanksgiving, you make the rolls and you do this, everybody's going to go, oh, my dad did it.
And it's a program that I'm in, that I'm taking in here so that I could, when I come out, I could try to be a good son. I could try to do something better for myself. I could do something good for myself.
Good right now? Level?
Maria and Irene's classroom might not be typical, but their student inmates are completely dedicated to the idea that once on the outside, everything will be done just right.
I even told him one time, you know, if we had a bakery, it would run really good the way you guys are doing it right now. Awesome job. You guys did a good job.
In the County News Center, I'm Suzanne Bartol.
This is Leon Thompson with this week's Crime Beat Report. On Saturday morning, shortly after 11, sheriff's deputies from the Lemon Grove station responded to a report of shots fired and a victim laying on the driveway of a home on Calle Simpson in Rancho San Diego. Two male suspects were last seen leaving south on Calle Simpson towards Weghorse Way in a black four-door sedan. The suspects have not yet been located. Arriving at the scene, deputies found a 25-year-old victim whose face and head were covered in blood. The victim's father, age 52, was bleeding from a facial injury. Deputies were told that the victim had been standing in the driveway of his home waiting for his girlfriend when he was approached by a Hispanic male, about 5'11", 160 pounds, wearing a black beanie, blue hoodie sweatshirt, and gray pants. The victim got into physical altercation with the man, and then a second suspect stepped out of a parked black four-door sedan and walked toward them. This suspect pulled out a gun and pointed it at the victim, said Lieutenant Dave Schaller. When the victim's father heard a gunshot, he ran outside and engaged in a struggle with the suspects. The victim's mother then came outside and attempted to assist her husband, who was now grappling with one of the assailants. Once the suspects realized deputies had been called, they fled the scene, leaving behind numerous items of physical evidence. Initial reports indicate the first victim sustained a wound to his head, but it is undetermined if the injury was related to the discharge of the firearm. The victim's father also sustained minor injuries to his right eye. Both were transported to a local hospital for treatment.
This is Ed Barena reporting for KNSJ and East County Magazine. Residents of San Diego County are being asked to report any calls they receive from someone claiming to be a peace officer and subsequently asking for cash payment, the Sheriff's Department announced this week. According to the department, several residents have reported suspicious phone calls by a man who says he's a member of the Sheriff's Department, then states that the person answering the phone, or a member of the family, has an outstanding warrant for their arrest. He then asks for cash payment in order to avoid arrest. Sheriff Bill Gore is reminding residents that the Sheriff's Department will never call anyone seeking payment for outstanding arrest warrants. If you received a call similar to the one described above, authorities are asking you to report it to the Sheriff's Department or your local police agency. Think you may have information on this case? You can leave an anonymous tip by calling the Sheriff's Department at 858-565-5200 or call Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 and be eligible for a $1,000 reward for information leading to an arrest.
This is Leon Thompson for East County Magazine. And recently in the news in California, the talk of an extended drought and seeding clouds has been in the news. And I'm here with editor Miriam Raftery. And it seems to me there was something in the history of San Diego that was similar.
Well, that's true, Leon. One of our most infamous historical stories in East County out here is the tale of Hatfield the Rainmaker.
Hatfield the Rainmaker.
Hatfield the Rainmaker. A lot of people have heard of the Hatfield feuds, the Hatfields and the McCoys. Well, we had our own version of the Hatfield feud right here in San Diego. And it happened starting in December 1914. The city was going through 5 years of drought. They didn't know what to do. Lake Moreno was almost completely empty. The Otay Reservoir was almost completely empty. There wasn't enough water. And so going on the recommendation of Los Angeles that had hired a guy named Charlie Hatfield, who said he could make it rain, they decided to hire Hatfield, and he was told that if he could fill Lake Morena, he would be paid $10,000.
Wow. Did he make it rain?
Well, now that whether he made it rain or it rained anyway and he got lucky is a point of historical dispute. The idea of rainmaking, by the way, goes back a long time, all the way back to medieval times or even before ancient times. It had been noted that when there would be a battle, for example, a lot of chemicals and noxious fumes were up in the air, that it seemed to rain quite often after that. And so what Hatfield did is he went out and he built a big old platform out in the Campo area near Lake Morena. And he started shooting off bombs of really foul-smelling chemicals of some sort. No one knows exactly what he used. And he did various chants and so forth. Well, it started to rain. And rain. And rain. And it rained on and off for 2 weeks or more. And it wound up causing the worst flood, the second worst flood that San Diego had ever seen. And what happened was the San Diego River washed over its banks. It flooded all of Mission Valley. It not only filled Lake Morena, it overflowed the banks.
Oh, no.
It burst the dam at the Sweetwater Dam.
Oh.
And it burst the Otay Dam. It washed out all the roads. It washed out all the bridges. Communication. It washed out the railway. It was shut down for 32 days. The telegraph line, the telephone lines, everything was cut off completely. San Diego had no communication except by sea. This is how bad it was. It washed hundreds of head of cattle out to sea. It wiped out an entire community. Farming community down there in the Tijuana River Valley, and it killed at least 20 people, some say 50. The coroner's report at one point said 50 people died.
So this must have made news.
Well, it did. It actually made national news. And actually, the San Diego Union was kind of upset about that because they were trying to hype up the big exposition. You know, they were building these buildings in Balboa Park, but the exposition, the World's Fair. And, of course, they wanted everyone to think this was a great place for tourism, and they got mad at the national media for reporting that, you know, San Diego was pretty much impassable, unreachable for a period of time there.
And that was because the World's Fair in 1916?
Yeah, that was coming to town shortly after these floods. And so, you know, there was a lot of concern about that.
So was Charles Hatfield ever paid for his work?
Well, you know, he's a good lesson in why you shouldn't try to be your own attorney. He drafted up his own contract. And, of course, it said that if he filled Lake Morena, he would be paid. So, first of all, the city attorney was a pretty sharp guy, named Terrence Cosgrove. Now, the contract specified he should fill Lake Morena. Well, Lake Morena had been around for 20 years, and it had never been filled yet. It was capable of holding 15 billion gallons of water, so they probably thought they were never going to have to pay off on this contract. But when it did fill and overfilled, the city attorney turned around and said, "This is an act of God. We don't think Charles Hatfield is responsible." Well, Hatfield took him to court, and he sued them to try to get paid. And the city attorney, who was a pretty crafty guy, turned around and said, "Well, if you want to say you're responsible for making it rain, then you should be responsible for the $3.5 million worth of damage that was done because of too much rain."
Oops.
And of course, Hatfield wasn't going for that deal, so he didn't do it. His case languished in court for 20 years, and eventually a judge dismissed it. But to his dying day, Hatfield declared, "This was not an act of God. This was an act of Hatfield."
An act of Hatfield.
An act of Hatfield, yes. Yes, indeed.
Well, that is a point of San Diego history that I wasn't familiar with. Didn't realize all that happened here in San Diego. Don't we need some of that now? Maybe a rainmaker for me now?
Well,
and then?
Maybe not one that did whatever Hatfield did, because that was a little bit too much. But it's still a point of contention of whether he actually had some secret for making it rain. There were people even in his day before this happened who said he was really a shyster who would just, you know, ride around to parts of the country in drought and
show up during the rainy season and suddenly say, I'm going to make it rain. And if it did, then, you know, then everybody thought he was a hero. And if it didn't, well, he didn't get paid. And in this case, he was pretty well, you know, run out of town on a rail.
Anything more?
Well, you can see a monument to Hatfield the Rainmaker to this day if you go out Campo. And you go out where the old stone store is, there is a monument on the creek out there to Hatfield the Rainmaker. You can see the very spot where this colorful piece of East County history once took place.
Well, thank you so much, Miriam Raftery, for enlightening us to some of the more colorful parts of San Diego's history.
Well, you're welcome, Leon. That's just one of our many colorful stories that we have from East County's past that we enjoy sharing with you here on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts provide important information about much more than wildfires. In these winter months, you can receive free alerts via email or Twitter on your mobile phone about emergencies such as flash floods, road closures, heavy snow, and other severe weather alerts, as well as wildfires, traffic reports, and more. You can sign up for this free public service at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians.
This is Ed Barrena. I'm here with Miriam Raftery, editor of the nonprofit East County Magazine and founder of the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts. How are you doing, Miriam?
I'm doing great, Ed. How about you?
Doing good. Why did you start this emergency alert service?
The idea for it came about in 2007 during the Harris wildfire, Ed. I was reporting at the time for print weeklies. It was before we had East County Magazine, so I worked for other newspapers. And I started getting emails at midnight from people who lived out in Potrero in the backcountry. Their town was surrounded by fire. They didn't know how to get out. Some of the roads were blocked, and they couldn't get information. The county emergency site was crashed. There was nothing on TV news. And, of course, a print weekly newspaper, no matter how good it is, otherwise, it does not help you during an emergency. So we saw the need for timely news that we could post online where people could go and read it, but also going a step beyond that and creating an email alert so we could let you know when news happens when you need it the most. And also we've now extended that, so we also have Twitter alerts, and you can get those and get a briefer version of the alert on your mobile phone wherever you are.
Yeah, I was going to say, with smartphone technology now, all these updates can come to you immediately, and that's really beneficial. So what are some of the major kinds of emergencies that you cover?
Well, of course, wildfires, brush fires. We also have covered things like the major earthquake, the Mexico quake, where when other media was saying no reports of damage, we were reporting boulder blocking highway into Anzabrego Desert State Park and gas line broken on Indian reservation and things like
that. Mexicali, right?
Yeah. Well, Mexicali had a lot of damage. It was actually centered about 100 miles south of here. But in the winter here, it's important for people to know that we also report on things like flash floods, severe storm warnings, if there's snow blocking Interstate 8 or chains needed on, you know, accidents, bridge jumpers, head-on collisions blocking not only freeways but major roadways, then those are all examples of things that we report on.
Okay. Well, yeah, that covers just about everything I could think of there. Can you tell us some of the most unusual emergencies that you've alerted on?
Yes. When we started it, we really thought it would be all about fires and maybe traffic, but we found out there's a lot more emergencies out there. For instance, we reported late one night about a herd of sheep blocking a rural highway out here, and another time it was a herd of cows that had wandered into the roadway. You wouldn't want to come around a curve unsuspecting and not know about that one. Motorcyclists down or pedestrian, you know, in the roadway. We've reported a couple of mountain lion sightings. We don't do this routinely, but if it's For example, there was one on the playground at an elementary school. We thought maybe parents might want to know that, that mm-hmm. you might not want to let the kids walk home that day.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you send updates in the middle of a big incident, such as a firestorm?
Yeah, definitely. What we will do is, if you don't hear back from us, it typically means the incident is over. But if it's continuing and escalating, for example, if evacuations get ordered, if new areas are threatened, a second fire breaks out, you know, all these kind of things, then we will send repeat alerts as often as needed, really, to make sure that we keep people safe and out of harm's way. And in between, though, you can go to our website and we'll post updates on the incident there. So if they've put the fire out or cleared, you know, the roadway, then we'll often have that kind of information posted there. A really, really big fire, if it's one of these that burns for days, we will give you the update and let you know when that one's finally out and safe and you can go back home.
Okay. So it sounds like it's good to kind of be on the website, too, when these things happen.
Yeah, and actually our readers will even go on sometimes and post in the comments section their updates in between. If out on the road reporting and you know that a tree fell across the roadway or something, post it and people reading that story will know.
Good, good. Do you have alerts only for East County, or are alerts also relevant for San Diego listeners?
We have more of them for East County, you know, all our rural highways and things. But we do also do a certain number of alerts that are very relevant countywide. Major freeway alerts, wherever it is. It could be I-5 up by Oceanside. If it's blocked, we'll tell you. We've done things like great white shark sighting off the coast. Might not be a good day to go surfing out there. We just had one over the weekend about water spouts possible off the coast with this storm. We've had a tsunami alert. So, yes, it's relevant, and you definitely should sign up, even if you're living on the coast.
Where do you get the information to make the alerts?
Well, we get it from a variety of sources, Ed. We have a lot of the emergency response agencies send it to us directly, CAL FIRE, Sheriff, Police, in different, you know, some of the different jurisdictions, some of the fire departments, not all of them. We have folks who listen to scanners and ham radios and give us tips, which, of course, we need to verify. We have a lot of eyewitness reports directly from readers, and you can send us tips at editor@eastcountymagazine.org. And some of them have been pretty amazing. We've had people, their passengers shooting out the back window as they were evacuating the wildfire, or one guy was in Mission Valley when they had huge flooding, and he actually videoed the wave washing out Friars Road, and next thing you know, a video of a car floating down the river. We actually had to notify authorities on that. You might have a rescue here. Lots of places, and also our own reporters in the field. East County Magazine is one of the only publications, or the only one that I know of, that will actually dispatch a reporter to the scene, even in the middle of the night. We've had Nadine Abbott out there, 2 o'clock in the morning, reporting on wildfires up in the Warner Springs area in the mountains, for instance. So you just can't beat that on-the-scene reporting sometimes when you need it.
Yeah, that's really good for a medium like this. Why does Viejas sponsor these alerts?
A lot of people don't know that the Viejas tribe has a very long and proud history of firefighting. A very high percentage of tribal members are or were firefighters. You know, in the years before tribes had casinos, one of the major ways that they earned a living was through firefighting locally, and even fire jumpers for the U.S. Forest Service, the guys that jump out of airplanes to put the fires out. So the Viejas tribe in more recent years has done a lot of things like building fire stations for the outlying community. They actually do all the training for all the fire agencies countywide, state, federal, and local, on the reservation every year. So this was just a natural extension for them to want to help keep people safe.
Very nice. How do people sign up to get the alerts, and also if they want to make it a report so that you can post an alert?
Very good question. You can sign up at our website, www.eastcountymagazine.org. Just click subscribe, or you can click that wildfire alerts logo. You can get the alerts by email, and you can also follow us at Viejas Alerts on Twitter if you want short ones on your mobile phone. And when you get the alerts, by the way, by email, you can. I also recommend getting the weekly newsletter, because that'll give you updates on not only emergencies but other news you might want to know around the county. And then if you have a news tip for us, you can email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. You can call 619-698-3000. 7617. And if by chance you can't reach somebody right away, if we have a story, you can also go on our website and post comments that other people can read if you got really, you know, breaking news in your area.
Okay, great. Okay, thanks, Miriam, for your time. And also, thank you for keeping the community posted on what's going on with these emergency alerts.
Well, you're welcome, Ed. We're happy to be out there keeping people safe.
John Henry was a little baby sitting on his papa's knee. And he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel, cried, "A hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord. Hammer's gonna be the death of me," cried, "a hammer's gonna be the death of me. Hammer's gonna be the death of me." Now the captain, he said to John Henry, "I'm gonna bring that steam drill around. I'm gonna bring that steam drill out on the job. I'm gonna whop that steel on down, down, down. Whop that steel on down. I'm gonna whop that steel on. Gonna whop that steel on." John Henry told his captain, "Lord, a man ain't nothing but a man. But before I'd let your steam drill beat me down, I would die with a hammer in my hand. I would die with a hammer in my hand. I would die with a hammer in my... I would die with a hammer in my hand."
This is Leon Thompson reporting for KNSJ Radio. Legendary folk singer, activist, environmentalist, leftist, songwriter, and troubadour extraordinaire Pete Seeger passed away on Monday, January 27, 2014. KNSJ Executive Director Martin Eder wrote this tribute for us to read in Seeger's honor. The weekend before Seeger's passing, KNSJ held a tribute concert to Pete Seeger, thanks to our invitation of George Mann, who joined us in this musical retrospective celebration of his life. We may have been the last sing-along event of Pete's songs while he was still alive. As part of the audience, we were uplifted by his spirit and words. "If I had a hammer, I'd sing it in the morning. I'd sing it in the evening all over this land. It's a song of justice. It's a song of freedom. It's a song of love between my brothers and my sisters all over this land, all over this land." On January 28th, Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! Spent the bulk of the broadcast celebrating the life and contributions of Pete Seeger and his cultural activism. Listeners were reminded just how important the programming of our new community radio station is to our values and our information, knowing that KNSJ is the only local station to be honoring Pete Seeger today. This tribute is but one of a thousand reasons why we need a strong and vibrant and culturally poignant people-powered radio. You can listen to the podcast on democracynow.org, including interviews with Pete Seeger and a video of him in concert. Just a week before, Activist San Diego and KNSJ spent the evening at the Joyce Beers Community Center highlighting the importance that culture plays in building a social movement for social justice. Pete Seeger's life is the embodiment of what it means to be a tribune of the people, a transformer of the existing social order with an undying optimism that we shall overcome someday. In an interview with Amy Goodman, Pete said that we often look and feel that our small efforts are futile. But when hundreds and thousands of us each pick up a tool and chip away at the barriers to social progress, mountains can be moved. As Pete Seeger lays down his banjo at the age of 94, may hundreds of us stand up to take his place and sustain a cultural, educational, and social movement with the same love, optimism, and conviction that he embodied throughout nearly a century of activism. With love from all of us, Pete Seeger, presente.
John Henry hammered in the mountains. His hammer was striking fire. But he worked so hard, he broke his poor heart, and he laid down his hammer and he died. He laid down his hammer and he died. He lay down his hammer and he died, Lord, Lord. He lay down his hammer and he died. Now John Henry had a little woman. Her name was Polly Ann. John Henry took sick and had to go to bed. And Polly Ann drove steel like a man, Lord, Lord. Polly Ann drove steel like a man. I said, Polly Ann drove steel like a... Polly Ann drove steel like a man. So every Monday morning, when the bluebird began to sing, you can hear John Henry a mile or more. You can hear John Henry's hammer ring. You can hear John Henry's hammer. You can hear John Henry's hammer. You can hear John Henry's hammer ring. You can hear John Henry's hammer. You can hear John Henry's hammer. You can hear John Henry's hammer. You can hear John Henry's hammer ring.
Coming up next, it's the Offbeat Report with Rebecca Williamson traveling off the beaten track to find some fascinating stories from the offbeat to the upbeat.
This is Rebecca Williamson here with East County Magazine, and I'm interviewing Rudy Reyes, who has a variety of accomplishments to his credit, one of which is he's a survivor of the Cedar Fire, and he survived over 70% burns on his body. Can you explain a little bit about the experience you had with the fires?
I'm in the Smithsonian, recognized as one of the worst injured, the hero of the 2003 San Diego fires. Because of that, I've toured and spoken and tried to help a lot of people, and I've become more of an advocate to give back. Because again, I survived one of the biggest fires in human history.
And then another thing that you also do is you're an advocate for the disabled. Can you explain more on what you've done there?
I've gone through on the disabled level and tried to help people understand that, look, just because I have physical issues doesn't mean my life is over, right? So I've tried to make other people understand that if they see me on TV and they see me doing good things, they can too.
But you're cooking up something else different now. You appeared on the MasterChef TV show. Can you go into a little bit about how you actually were inspired to do it and the whole procedure, the whole timeline of how it happened?
Speaking on the disability level and the inspiration, well, let's be honest, the last winner was a blind lady. She was completely blind, and that inspired me to say, hey, look, if she can do something, I can do something. So when I saw them advertising here in San Diego saying that we're going to come to San Diego and do auditions, I'm going to jump in and see what I can do. So I went online and put in the application, and for the most part, kind of forgot about it. And then the week before the audition, they called me up and they said that we saw your application and we'd like to see what you can do and we'd like to see you come in. We understand that you have burn issues, so we're going to give you VIP access. Well, there I am with VIP access and I don't know what I'm going to cook for these people. So I'm figuring I'm a rarity. Let's cook them a rarity. And I know how to do Indian tacos, Native American tacos, Indian fry bread.
Rudy, if you could explain a little bit more about your own ethnic background.
Honestly, I like to call myself indigenous. I'm from here. I'm a mix of Mexican and local Kumeyaay Indians. I'm from the Brona Band of Native American Indians. And that makes me as indigenous as you can get. I've got degrees in archaeology. That's my background. I used to get extra credit in college for teaching kids how to make fry bread. So I went ahead and made fry bread and got it to the audition within a half hour. So it was still warm and fresh because I had VIP access. So when I got there and presented my dish, oh, they loved it. They had other judges coming in to try it out because it was such a rarity they'd never had this. Next part audition is we line up the people that made it through the first one and get your story. Well, as you can tell, I've got a compelling story. In a personal interview, they ask you more personal questions. Why are you doing this? What are you doing it for? And for me, it wasn't about me. It was about the other people out there to see me and to understand that just because, you know, yeah, I'm burned. Yeah, I'm missing fingers. Yeah, my fingers are fused. They don't move the way they used to. But I can still cook and I can still do and I can still make a quality life. And that's what it was about.
And explain a little bit about your products that you brought and also the recipe, if you would share that.
Ah, you want me to give away my recipes?
I do.
Okay. So, again, in making a Native American taco, you got to make the fry bread first. I made the fry bread with, let's say, 2 cups of flour, half a spoonful or a tablespoonful of salt, a little bit of water, a little bit of milk, and you mix that all together. Don't forget some oil, just about a teaspoon of oil, and you mix that all together until it makes a nice dough. And then that dough you flatten out into basically a tortilla. You get some corn oil nice and hot. And you fry it up till it becomes a big poofy bread, right? And then that gets set aside. The meat consisted, for me at least on the show, of buffalo meat. I was lucky in the fact that I sourced it out. and they had it for me available. Unfortunately, buffalo meat isn't exactly fatty, so it didn't keep its rendering well when we went through the actual show. But that's beside the point. Then from there, I made a fresh pico salsa. Now, that salsa consisted of chopped tomatoes, garlic, onion, yellow pepper cut up into it nice and deep, and then lime juice to make it that savory salsa, along with about a spoonful of salt. That, along with a little bit of lettuce, some aged Monterey Jack cheese, and you put together a taco. Just a generalized taco. So now I put down my bread, some beans, because the beans just adds the stickiness so that your meat doesn't fall off the bread. And then you add the salsa, some lettuce, cheese, and now you got a taco, and just fold it up and start eating.
And how much did you have to prepare? Like how many, the quantity of how many tacos that you did at the audition?
At the audition, I made plenty of tacos. Matter of fact, I made so many bread that I was giving them away to other people to try out because they had never tried it at the auditions. I purposely made it like that to be able to give away and be able to have extra. It's a tradition we do. It's a tradition that goes back to Native Americanness that when you do something like this, you give it away.
And then was it also the same with other people who were auditioning? Did you get to sample some of the other people's foods?
A lot of them weren't. And a lot of them were very quiet and hush-hush about their recipes and techniques because they didn't want you to be competitive with them. You know, this is a big competitive, 100 down to 1. Me, I was the exact opposite. I was there to make friends.
Now, you did the actual audition locally in a major hotel.
Right.
And then what happened after that?
They did the first auditions here in San Diego. So they had to go to all the other cities in the United States to do their auditions before they decided. So we're talking another 2.5 months passed before I actually got a confirmation saying, we chose you. They took us up to LA and we stayed in another hotel there. We were sequestered for about 2 weeks while we did the show. I gotta say, thank God I didn't make it much further because I didn't know these TV shows were as hardcore as they are. You get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and you're not done until 9 o'clock at night filming and taping. You're on your feet the whole time. My toes were going white from bad circulation. I'm glad I didn't stay.
Okay, so you go on the show and you hear the music from the show and that's the go.
Now they're going to let me go and let me cook. And then I was free and I knew exactly what I was doing and I was having fun while I was cooking. The real problem I had is we had a short circuit of an oven and an hour and a half passed between when I presented to the judges and when I had cooked. My food, for the most part, wasn't going to work. And I knew that going in. So I decided on the other end to make it a good presentation at the very least and make it about what I had in my background. The judges loved me. Let's be honest, two of them loved my food. The one from New York really didn't, right? And he was just because he's from New York, you kind of expect that. He's got a higher class taste. My food is rustic. We're talking Indian food, right?
So Gordon Ramsay is legendary. What was it like to meet Gordon Ramsay, and was it intimidating?
Don't be fooled by the gentleman. He's not what he shows in Hell's Kitchen. In Hell's Kitchen, he makes himself a monster on purpose. It's Hell's Kitchen. The show I was on was MasterChef. He's really nice. Got to meet him, talk with him, shake hands. He liked me, right? It's just because of the problem we had, he couldn't let me go through. So he chose to allow me to come back if I so choose.
So, do you swap recipes with Gordon? I mean, do you sort of like pick his brain about, hey, Gordon, you know, what can you give to me?
He was very honest with me and told me he had never mastered a fried bread recipe. It's something he had never gotten down, and he'd like to go spend some time with Native Americans to get it down. Along with that, Graham Elliott, the bigger gentleman, the other of the three chefs, he loved my food. And he invited me to Chicago to go train with him. So in a few months, I'm planning to go to Chicago and spend some time with Graham Elliott and learn from him.
And what other projects have sort of come to the forefront in terms of what you want to introduce in this culinary line to people with the Native American dishes?
Okay, well, that's the idea there. Look, I come from a background where we have staples. We have certain things that a lot of these other cultures that are right around us have never tried. Like, I'm sure you've never heard of shawi, acorn mush. It's a tradition here in San Diego. And not a lot of people have had it because it's a rarity. I know how to make shawi. It takes a lot of tanning and a lot of effort, but I know how to make it.
And what is in it?
It's acorn, which has been ground down into a fine powder and then tannin leached from it so it doesn't have any of the acids that are in acorns naturally. And then that you turn into basically a flour or a mush to make a bread with. It's a little sticky, but it is good. Every tradition, every culture has their staples. My plan is in the next year or so, I want to go around to these different cultures and learn their staples and then bring them back to our society to be able to teach them to others. That's really the ethno of it, of the food, to try to bring back archaeologically so that we don't lose it culturally.
Now, your show, the episode that you were on, aired recently in June.
In June.
where would you recommend for listeners to go see it again?
You can find it all over the place. It's on YouTube, Hulu, you name it. I'm Series 4, Episode 2. I was in the first night of the show, so they used me for a teaser, a commercial cliffhanger. I'm well known. I made a lot of fans off of that show. I can't wait to go back now. Every year I go to a gathering of burn survivors. I blew it up for the burn community. So when I go back there in a few months, I'm about to have fun, get to see all my friends, teach them some new stuff, and be like, hey, look what I did for us. Because for someone like me to get on a show like that and to present is good.
So you have a recipe, a signature recipe that you've taken to the forefront on Correct. TV. Now, when you go to the store, when you go around the community, do you get hit up for the recipe?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've had people see me two aisles down in a row and kind of stalk me for a little bit. And then all of a sudden come up and be like, did I see you on TV? Yeah, you saw me on TV. I'm that guy. Oh, nice to meet you. How'd you do that? What's the recipe of this? I'm like, oh, okay. You want my right here? I'll write it down real quick for you, right? And don't get me wrong. Writing it down isn't going to exactly teach you how to make it. So I've got a Vimeo video that I actually have out there where I've taught, where I made the application for MasterChef and I taught them on that show how to make my fry bread. It's available if you look me up on Vimeo.com. Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O. And that site allows for small people to put up their own local videos just to have it up. It's on there so you can learn how to make my empanadas. You can learn how to make my fry bread because the same recipe I make my empanadas is the same recipe I make my fry bread.
Thank you.
No problem.
You can see more of Rudy's interview and more about Rudy at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.